Mr. Salerno.
Good morning. To please the court, I'd first like to discuss the first issue where it is our position that the proceeds must be obtained before the financial transaction involving the proceeds can be conducted in order for an individual to be punished under 18 U.S.C. 1956 for, in essence, conducting a financial transaction with those proceeds. A look at the statute without the statute containing a definition indicates that the statute punishes one who conducts or attempts to conduct a financial transaction with proceeds. So it's our position that the statute reads antecedent conduct, and the case law holds in the same respect. The key case in the Seventh Circuit is the Mancarius case, which indicates that time is not of the essence, that a predicate crime must have produced proceeds and acts distinct from the conduct that constitutes money laundering. The case stands for the premise that it matters only that the predicate offense has produced proceeds in transactions distinct from those transactions allegedly constituting money laundering. In this case, counts of the indictment charge the defendants with acts of splitting proceeds, and those splitting of proceeds is charged conduct in the money laundering counts. We believe that this is incorrect based upon the case law. In Mancarius, it was a fraud case, and the fraud involved not the checks obtained from, not the fraudulent acquisition, but the grand jury charged the defendants for cashing and depositing kickback checks after payment was obtained from Delta. The government relies on the Conley case in their reply and the subsequent case from the same circuit, but it's our position that Conley actually supports our position in this case. The Conley case was a double jeopardy case and a conspiracy to commit money laundering, and the issue was whether gambling as a matter of law was a 1956 type of specified activity. And Conley also said that obviously whenever a defendant makes money from criminal activity, he has to do something with it. And as the district court correctly observed, Congress did not enact money laundering statutes simply to add to the penalties for various crimes in which the defendants made money. The case compared the Seventh Circuit Jackson case where an individual took proceeds, quote unquote, from drug dealing and deposited some of and used some of those proceeds to facilitate the commission of a crime, but used some for personal use, and indicated that the proceeds, quote unquote, the money received from drug dealing without use in an additional offense was not money laundering as a matter of law. Conley noted that after the proceeds are collected, and if subsequent transactions are conducted with the proceeds to promote illegal gambling, then the money laundering statute would apply. But if this was not the case, it would not have applied. The charged conduct in the Conley case was the obtaining or payment to Matrix and obtaining of new gambling artifices, etc. We cited a string of cases that stand for the premise that the collection, that the obtaining, that the acquisition of proceeds must be distinct between the specified illegal activity and the financial transaction. The money laundering statute does not define when, but it's obvious to us, according to the Conley case, that proceeds are derived from an already completed offense or a completed phase of an ongoing offense before they can be laundered. On page 979, the court said that once collected from the poker machines, the money becomes proceeds of specified unlawful activity within the meaning of the money laundering statute, and any subsequent financial transaction that promotes and furthers money laundering is chargeable and provable. Again, the Morelli case, which followed Conley, which was not, in essence, a proceeds case, and which in dicta criticized this court's analysis of the Schmuck case for for proceeds for mail fraud versus wire fraud. But in the Morelli case, there was a series of wire transfers that occurred after the money involved came into the possession of those who controlled the scheme. The defendant argued that only when the money got to what was called the Byrne Company that the money laundering would apply, and the Morelli case stood for the premise, and only the wire transfer, the first wire transfer, was charged as a wire fraud, the acquisition of those funds, and the next and subsequent chain of subsequent transfers constituted money laundering. The Morelli case said that the distribution, that after money is retrieved, even though it's part of a gambling, it's money laundering. The court held that the money would not be proceeds if only one of the daisy chain series of transaction had occurred, and the money laundering was based upon the subsequent transactions. I don't know if the court has any questions about that issue. The Seventh Circuit has, this court has come with the Lee and the Seward case subsequent to Mancarius and Lee and Morelli. And again, transactions and proceeds, not transactions that create the proceeds.
Has the Supreme Court ever attempted to define the word proceeds in the money laundering statute?
Not that I've found. But it's pretty clear that the definition of proceeds is money acquired, and our issue is
that doesn't answer the central question in this case, which is basically whether proceeds is the gross from a criminal activity or the net from a criminal activity. Both the gross and the net are acquired from the criminal activity, but your position essentially depends on proceeds being the net return of the criminal activity, and the government's depends on it being the gross. And we can't distinguish between those positions by looking at whether it's acquired in some way from the criminal activity.
I would say that, and also the fact that the acquisition or the exercising of control or the receipt of the property and then the conducting of a subsequent financial transaction. Time is important. The government makes a distinction of whether or not it falls into a holding within the machines as to whether or not that point is it's acquired. But it seems to be clear from all of the cases cited by both the defense and the government as we go through even the Conley and the Morelli case that it's subsequent financial transaction, that it's a transaction after the funds are acquired, that it's a transaction that may facilitate the underlying crime, but it needs to be done with acquired funds. The second issue that we tackled was the depletion of assets. And since the court...
I'm not sure I understand why that matters. It wasn't essential for a finding of interstate commerce. So, who cares?
In our first issue?
No, the
second issue?
Right, the depletion of assets business.
Well, it is essential. It's
why?
Essential because... It was.
Let me give you the reason why I ask why. This was gambling activity in a restaurant, and the Supreme Court has held back at the time of the fight about the constitutionality of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that restaurants are in interstate commerce, period. And there you are. Right. It's mysterious why this was even an arguable issue. But if it's arguable, government proved that this was in a restaurant, and I should think QED at that point. The depletion of assets and all that stuff seems to me irrelevant. Now, is there something wrong with that?
I believe so. I believe my take on the issue is that if a jury is given an erroneous statement of law and the possibility exists.
But if it doesn't matter to the outcome, who cares? That's the question I'm asking. Since there is no way you could have, no way to doubt, no possibility that this was not affecting interstate commerce, what difference could the asset depletion instruction have made?
I don't think that it's a given, and I don't think that we can even assume
certainly
that the
it's
jury
a given, unless we're going to disagree with Katzenbach against McClung.
Well,
and we're not.
I believe in this case, we can't say that the jury didn't rely on the depletion of assets theory. Now, if we're going to take that one step further and assume that the case is remanded for a retrial and that the court is standing for the proposition that because a restaurant was involved, that it's automatically interstate commerce.
That is the holding of the Supreme Court in Katzenbach against McClung.
What I'm saying is that we don't know if the jury relied on that or not. We may, in reading the record, there may be an argument as to whether or not, even though it was a restaurant, that there was any sort of effect on interstate commerce. The argument was that the splitting of proceeds did not cause an effect on interstate commerce, and that there may be no effect on interstate commerce at all. The jury instruction talked about depletion of assets. It was an erroneous legal instruction, and according to the harmless error standard as enunciated in Griffin, or this court's harmless error, we can't say for sure that the jury didn't rely on that. In fact, it was argued in closing argument, and the jury could have relied on this erroneous instruction. And the Griffin
did the gambling proceeds go to the profits of the tavern owner?
Arguably, yes.
Sure. And weren't some of those profits used and involved in interstate commerce?
I don't know that. I mean, there has.
How does he buy liquor?
Well, he may have bought liquor from proceeds.
Interstate commerce?
Yes, but
aren't the majority of the items that he sells and the beer and everything else involved in interstate commerce?
Probably yes.
Not probably, they are.
Okay, they are. They are.
And so is the liquor. Not probably.
Right.
Okay.
But
so we have then set up interstate commerce.
We may set up interstate commerce because it may be that
I thought you agreed that the beer and liquor.
Right.
Were
maybe I'm misspeaking, but what I'm saying is that the
you can't have it both ways. Either it is or it isn't.
Okay. Assuming for a second it is.
Yeah.
The government would have to prove that the financial that the interstate commerce was affected by the gambling that occurred at the individual establishment. These individual establishments may have purchased those interstate goods with profits from the bar. It may have not affected.
What do they sell at the bar?
They sell liquor,
yeah,
and they may
sure,
purchase
right.
liquor with
right.
it.
And also from the gambling profits.
Well, that's something that the government would have to prove to a jury without the depletion of assets theory.
And
the
you're arguing that the jury instructions were wrong.
I'm arguing that the depletion
of
assets.
That's what I'm trying to get to. What was in error in the jury instructions?
Well, the jury instruction indicated that the depletion of assets theory was an applicable theory here. And both the government and the judge at the close of the case agreed, well, the judge at the close of the case and the government in their reply brief agreed that the depletion of assets does not apply. And there was no waiver in as much as there's discussion on page 58 of the supplemental appendix.
Are you saying that the government agrees that the jury instructions were improper?
Yes. They conceded that issue on, I believe, page 18 of their brief.
And you and I read different briefs or read them differently.
Maybe we did read them differently, but I believe that on page 18 of the brief, the government said that on further a closer analysis revealed that the depletion of assets theory was inapplicable to these counts. Thus, the government submits that the district court was correct that the depletion of assets theory did not apply to the counts involving the splitting of proceeds. I take that as a concession, and a concession that error occurred, and that the depletion of assets theory was inapplicable. And since it was instructed to the jury as such, that the legal mistake and the Yates and Griffin analysis applies, in as much as jurors can differentiate between proof of facts but they're not equipped to differentiate between between a solid legal theory and an incorrect legal theory.
Now, Mr. Leonard, on the question of whether this was preserved.
Yes.
Is it your position, by simply offering an alternative instruction on a subject matter to what the government offers, that that constitutes a sufficient objection?
Absolutely not.
So, but so make your case here, then, on how it was preserved.
I think a close reading is required of the supplemental appendix. In the supplemental appendix, Mr. Jones, in arguing jury instruction number 36, stated, "Judge, this case, we're on trial in this case because of money laundering. The government has to show that a financial transaction was conducted, that the transaction was conducted with the proceeds of unlawful activity with the intent to promote that unlawful activity. And it also has to show it has an effect on interstate commerce. Let me just take one of these that they've done. They have several of these counts where they say that our clients did a transaction where the proceeds, they say, were split between, for instance, the tavern owner and our clients. We have found no case, in fact. We've got a couple of cases that are contrary to that, that say in any way, because, Judge, if it's like if bank robbers rob the bank, I mean, of course, they're going to have some proceeds, but it's not the kind of thing that has, that under the money laundering statute, has an effect on interstate commerce." And then he goes further at the supplemental appendix, page 60, and says, "I go directly to the ones where they've done a bunch of these splitting of proceeds. There is no case that has held that the splitting of proceeds between co-defendants is the kind of thing that either a transaction or has effect on interstate commerce." Counsel for the government responds with the depletion of assets theory. Then we get to the jury instruction number 40, where they submit an alternate jury instruction, and the judge says at the supplemental appendix, it takes us to 40, and this is on page 70, and in particular, it's the sixth paragraph, and this gets into the issue that I just ruled on with regards to interstate commerce, talking about the paragraph that's submitted by the defense. And he goes on to overrule the defense's objection, referring back to the argument that they just had on the splitting of proceeds. I see I'm running out of time. I'd like to reserve a little rebuttal time. I'd like to talk briefly about the sentencing. There were extensive objections made, written and oral. The court went out and said, "Are there any additional objections?" You can see from the state of the record that there were objections made. There were conclusions made, but no factual findings. Much of it was from unsupported allegations. Many witnesses admitted to committing perjury in the grand jury and during trial, and these individuals were sentenced for an extended period of time based upon something the government has the burden of proof, and I don't believe they've proved that. And I'll reserve a little bit of time.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Solano. Mr. Anderson?
On behalf of the United States, Stephen Anderson. May it please the court, defense counsel. At trial, the evidence demonstrated multiple ways in which each of the money laundering transactions had an effect on interstate commerce, and the United States brief sets them forth in great detail. The defendants have challenged some of those ways and other of the judge's rulings. The first argument by the defendants is that the split of the money in the video gambling machines, the split of the proceeds, as the defendants put it, was not money laundering because they were not proceeds. But the defendant's understanding of proceeds is out of step with both this circuit and the Third Circuit, which has considered this issue in the context of video gambling machines. Mancarius is a case that was cited by the defendant.
Let me ask you to get away from cases at the moment and address the question as an original matter. What is the United States' definition of that word? Can you give me a definition?
I would take that under Black Dictionary, proceeds is that which would result from a transaction. So the question is
there... you think it is the gross receipts from a transaction? Suppose you go to Las Vegas and you participate in... you play the one-armed bandit. Right? You put in some nickels, you get out some nickels, and at the end of the day, the casino opens up the slot machine and takes money out. What are the proceeds of running that slot machine?
The proceeds would be the gross proceeds. It's the
total
income.
Amount of nickels put in, even though what they take out at the end of the day is, say, 10% of that, because the slot machine returns 90% to the gambler. Mm-hmm. Casino takes 10%.
Based on just looking at the case
law. Isn't that a very unusual definition of proceeds? You open the slot machine and the proceeds is 10 times whatever is there?
Well, the question of net proceeds would be an accounting procedure in which, after factoring in the cost of running the establishment, the cost of electricity, the cost, et cetera, at the end of the day or at the end of the month, you could figure out what the net proceeds were.
Yes.
But for purposes of money laundering, the courts have been concerned.
The proceeds of running the Ford Motor Company.
Well, for instance, the question that's addressed, for instance, in the Tenth Circuit case of Kelly.
Why don't you get away from cases? I'm trying to figure out what the position of the executive branch of the United States government is about this issue.
When in a financial transaction, a party receives income, that income, the dollars, the cents, the liquid assets that it receives from that transaction are the proceeds of that transaction.
So in a drug transaction, if A sells B a kilogram of cocaine in exchange for $25,000,
yes.
A has committed two offenses in that's the only thing that happens. A has committed two offenses. One is he's distributed drugs, and the other is he's laundered money.
No, not by receiving the proceeds.
Certainly he has. On your definition, it's a financial transaction involving the proceeds. It's a financial transaction because money changes hands, and it's the proceeds because it's the gross receipts.
But for money laundering, there must be a subsequent transaction with those proceeds. That is, in the drug case, one receives the income, but for money laundering, there must be a subsequent transaction with that money for the purposes of being money laundering. Yes, they are proceeds at the point of the transaction, but there must be a subsequent
transaction. Takes the money to the store and buys a loaf of bread.
Well, if
at that point, 10 years in prison.
Well, the subsequent
for buying a loaf of bread.
Under money laundering, the subsequent transaction has to further the enterprise. So there would have
he
to
doesn't eat. He can't sell drugs.
Well, I think that's a broad extension of the term.
I don't think it's any different from the argument you're making in this case.
Well, now
maybe it's right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The argument.
One ought to fess up to the consequences of one's argument.
Well, the argument we're making in this case is there were two transactions. The first transaction was the money is put in the machines, there is illegal gambling, and it falls to the bottom. After it falls to the bottom, we submit its proceeds at that point. It's proceeds of the transaction of illegal gambling. But the facts of this case that show that after it fell to the bottom, it was then collected. It was collected either by the establishment or by the defendant. And it's only after it was collected that there was the subsequent transaction that was the money laundering transaction.
It's no different from my slot machine hypothetical. The slot machine is just automated.
Right.
It paid the gamblers automatically. These
right.
Video poker machines were technologically behind the curve and didn't pay the gamblers automatically.
Correct. So if that was an illegal statute, an illegal enterprise under the money laundering statutes, then yes, the money that went into that machine would be proceeds of illegal gambling. And if there was a subsequent transaction that furthered the enterprise, the criminal enterprise, with that money, that would be liable for money laundering prosecution, that subsequent transaction. And that's exactly what we had here. And that's consistent with the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit considered this first in Conley and then observed on Conley and Morelli. In Conley, the court said that once collected, the money becomes proceeds. And that's what happened in this case. The money fell into the bottom, the money was collected, and after it was collected either by the establishment or by the defendant, it was then split up, the subsequent transaction. Further, Morelli...
Does the splitting up, Mr. Anderson, becomes the subsequent transaction, not the use of those proceeds?
It's the subsequent split up that was the transaction, the charge transaction, because that subsequent split up furthered the enterprise. It encouraged the bar owners to continue to have the machines, and it encouraged the defendants to keep having the machines. But that split up was clearly subsequent to the collection. It was subsequent to the money falling into the bottom. It was subsequent to those prior transactions.
What is then the difference of the bank robbery example Judge Eastwood talks about when they if it encourages them to rob another bank?
Well, then there had to be two transactions. There has to be one transaction in which you get the proceeds.
Right.
But there has to be a subsequent transaction where you use those proceeds then to further the enterprise.
So serial bank robbers are engaged in money laundering.
Well,
rob two banks.
Well, if you could show that they used the money from the first robbery to buy gas, to buy a car, to buy something that they didn't use to further the second.
I can't imagine any case where you couldn't show that.
Well, that may be possible. But it needs to be shown beyond a reasonable doubt. And certainly it was shown in this case.
All you have to do, on your view, is show that they survived until the second bank robbery. Because sometime between the first bank robbery and the second, they ate. And they did that using the money from the first bank robbery. Voila, money laundering.
There would have to be shown a transaction in which it furthered the second enterprise, the second criminal
activity. Just paying rent on the hideout for a month, I guess, would be money laundering.
That would be money laundering. If you received money from a bank robbery, the one transaction, and in the second transaction you paid for rent for the hideout.
But the only person who would not engage in money laundering, on your view, would be Captain Kidd. After he engages in his act of piracy, he takes the gold and he buries it on Devil's Island. Right, and then he dies before he can go back and dig it up. No money laundering because the gold is still in the ground.
Or if you take the money and then go straight and use it just for lawful enterprises. Simply use it to eat and sleep and drink and don't commit any more crimes. Because if you get proceeds from an illegal operation but then do not use it to further another criminal operation, then that's not a crime. So if you get the money from your robbery,
it's not a crime of what's the name? Money laundering.
Correct. Right. It's certainly the robbery, but you wouldn't have any further crime if you took your profits from took the profits from an illegal enterprise, and then don't use it to further any other illegal enterprise.
I don't understand even that. That's a kind of ex post perspective on the transaction. If I rob a bank once, thinking that that will get me the money, say, to put a child through college. Mm-hmm. And I rob the bank just once, and I put the child through college. And the whole reason I engaged in the transaction was to have that subsequent financial transaction. It was my motive for robbing the bank, and on your view, that's money laundering.
No. Again, because under the government's view, there needs to be a subsequent transaction with the money one received from an illegal enterprise that one uses to further another illegal enterprise, to further criminal activity.
It does not say... The statute does not say with the intent to promote the carrying on of specified subsequent unlawful activity. It says with the intent to promote the carrying on of specified unlawful activity. So a bank robber's plan to spend the proceeds from the one and only robbery in his life is with the intent to promote the carrying on of his bank robbery. There's just nothing in this statute that says subsequent unlawful activity.
Mm-hmm.
Not there, sorry.
Okay.
Counsel, what evidence did you present at trial to establish the value of the funds laundered through the machines?
The evidence presented at trial came through the witnesses themselves. There were a total of approximately 28 witnesses.
And what did they say?
They testified that when the money came in to the machines, that the money remained in the machines until it was either collected by themselves or by the defendants. After it was collected, it was subsequently split up, and the establishment testified they used that money to purchase beer through interstate commerce. The testimony with regard to the defendants was the defendants used that money to rent more video gambling machines that came to interstate commerce, and also used it to pay money to the state of Illinois, which also implicated interstate commerce. So that testimony came directly from...
Well, that certainly isn't a violation of the law.
I'm sorry?
That's not a violation of the law, to pay money to the state of Illinois.
No, not by itself, but in the context of the money laundering statute it is, because it's the use of the money to further the enterprise. And here, in order to run the video machine...
Doesn't have to be... Did you argue before that it has to be illegal activity? The second transfer?
Yes.
How is that illegal?
Okay. The transaction itself... Subsequent transaction with the state of Illinois or maybe not be illegal, but that transaction has to further the underlying criminal activity. And that's what happened in this case. In order for the defendants to continue to use the video gambling machines, they had to have these licenses from the state of Illinois.
How did you compute the value of the said funds that were laundered?
It came through the testimony.
I know. That's what you said before. But what evidence is there?
The evidence was their oral testimony with regard to the amount of income that they received from the machines. The establishment owners testified under oath with regard to the amounts of money they received as income from the video gambling machines. And 28 of those witnesses testified at trial with regard to those amounts. But it was the holding of the Third Circuit in Conley and Morelli that once the money that was retrieved was proceeds. Once you have that initial transaction, the money falls to the bottom, that's proceeds of illegal activity. And in Mancarius, this court held, the question is whether the underlying activity has produced proceeds in transactions distinct from the underlying transactions. That is, Mancarius says you have to have two sets of transactions. The underlying transaction is the use of the video gambling machines. Once the use of the video gambling machines produces proceeds, then subsequent transactions with that money qualifies for money laundering.
Well, what's the limiting principle, Mr. Anderson? I think that's at least concerns me, if not my brothers here. You have a tax cheat on his income tax, right? And he defrauds the government, and therefore he hasn't paid sufficient taxes, so he's withheld or... And he's in possession of monies that really are due and owing the sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
He then does it again the next year. I suppose facilitates it by however he sustains himself. So if you cheat on your income taxes for 2 years, is that second evasion or criminal evasion a subject to a money laundering enhancement?
Seems to be that be a very broad understanding. One would have to show a particular subsequent transaction that was engaged in for the purpose of really furthering the further criminal activity. If one could show that one used money to hire a crooked accountant in order to do that further transaction, that'd be one thing. Showing
well,
that
let's
one
say
used
that. Let's say that that's what happens. He joins a conspiracy for the second tax year with a. With an unscrupulous
I think
accountant.
If you could show that in order to pay that crooked accountant, he used proceeds from the underlying illegal activity and used those proceeds then to further the additional criminal activity, yes, you would have it.
Well, then the government really, I suppose, under that theory, in every drug conspiracy where the conspiracy involves more than one sale, should really have a money laundering account in there, should they not?
Well,
I mean, that's an executive decision, not a judicial decision, but I mean, we don't really confront that regularly.
No, I don't think it's used. I think it's used rarely. It's used appropriately. It's used when there is a subsequent transaction with the proceeds to further a criminal enterprise.
Well, nothing too much more evil than a second big drug sale after a first rack drug sale.
Often it's a question of finding the use of the proceeds. There has to be use of the proceeds in a subsequent transaction. Sometimes that's difficult, but if it's appropriate, it may be charged as money laundering. And that's what we had here, two separate transactions consistent with Conley and Morelli, which dealt with video gambling machines.
How would you establish a crooked accountant any more than you would a crooked lawyer unless they had been disbarred?
Well, I suppose it'd be through maybe other testimony with regard to the accountant, testimony that maybe the accountant would be cooperating, but you're right. They would have to be showing, show the intent.
They'd have to show that they
had to show the intent. Right. With regard to the argument raised by the defense with regard to the depletion of assets, I would agree with this court that it doesn't matter because of the court holding of the Supreme Court in Griffin, in which the court held that as long as there is a basis for a jury's verdict, even if one of the possible bases does not have a factual basis, the verdict should stand. And it's the position of the United States that with regard to Your Honor's question, yes, the United States did concede on appeal that there was insufficient evidence with regard to the depletion of assets with regard to the split of the money, but the United States also argued in its brief that those convictions should still be upheld because with an accurate statement of the law, and even though there was insufficient evidence on that prong, there was sufficient evidence to establish that with regard to the split, the establishments were involved in interstate commerce, as Judge Easterbrook has noted. And there was testimony at the trial that the establishments used the money to purchase beer in interstate commerce, and the defendants used the money they received from the interstate commerce splits with the defendants to purchase further video gambling machines that came from interstate commerce. Finally, the defendants have argued very briefly with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence with regard to the judge's findings at the sentencing. The judge made sufficient findings, and the findings the judge made were specific with regard to the dollar amounts by the defendants. And after the judge made this finding, the judge gave the defendants an opportunity to make any further objections. The defendants made no further objections, requested no further specificity, and for that reason, this is the
counsel, by your conclusion that that failure is a waiver, as opposed to a forfeiture, is there any time when the defendant said, we agree with this number, or we agree with the pre-sentence report, or anything like that?
No, they did not. What they did
is that an important distinction between waiver and forfeiture?
Waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right. And after the judge made his findings, the judge asked, are there any other legal objections or factual objections? They didn't simply remain silent, but they raised other objections. Knowing they could raise this objection, they raised another objection. But even if it's not waiver, it certainly is.
That just seems to me to collapse the distinction between waiver and forfeiture. If you don't object, it's a waiver. But I thought our jurisprudence says that the simple failure to object is a forfeiture, and therefore the plain error rule can apply, as it can't in the case of waiver.
There may be a fine line, but the position of the United States that here, instead of simply remaining silent and saying no objection whatsoever, they were aware that they could still make objections. They made objection to another point, but simply didn't make an objection to this point.
Suppose the government proposes jury instructions, and there are 20 of them, and the defendants object to two and don't object to the other 18. Have they waived their opportunity to object, to complain about the other 18, or just forfeited it, subject to plain error review?
I believe an argument could be made that waived by being cognizant.
I'm not interested in an argument could be waived. Yeah. Could be made. What is the position of the United States about that kind of issue?
I believe there would be forfeiture. But in this case, it's different because they're requesting a further ruling with regard to something the court has already ruled on. The court has ruled on the issue, and then at that point, the court makes a specific request: are there any further legal or factual objections? So the court has already ruled, and the court is inviting any comment on that ruling. And the defendants chose not to further object. But even if it's not waiver, certainly it is a forfeiture reviewed under plain error. And there was no error here because the court, in making its finding, relied upon the pre-sentence report and relied upon the governor's version that set forth a summary of 47 witnesses, 28 of which who had testified at trial, 19 of which had testified in the grand jury. The judge had all their testimony in front of them. There was never a request by the defendants for these witnesses to be produced at the sentencing hearing.
But the judge makes no specific credibility findings as to the witnesses. It's really a global conclusion, isn't it?
Correct.
None of those grand jury witnesses, have felony records?
Yes, as did some of the witnesses who testified at trial who the judge heard.
Right.
This court has held that in a court, in relying upon a government's version or a PSI, may make implicit findings by adopting the findings within the prosecutor's version. Also, within the prosecutor's version, there was a summary chart prepared by a special agent of the Internal Revenue Service who had also testified at trial, so the judge had heard his credibility, and the numbers in the government's version were based upon his report.
Yeah, but is it clear, Mr. Anderson, what part, if unless it was all, that the judge relied on? I mean, do we have, what are the foundation points for his reliance other than his ultimate conclusion?
Well, he states that he was relying upon the trial testimony and the government's version. The
exactly.
government's version sets forth those figures.
Yeah. But it doesn't break it out at all, does it? With the myriad, actually dozens of witnesses, we don't really have a pointing to or emphasis on any specific group or cluster of witnesses.
No, but the government's prosecutor's version was very specific, breaking each bar down by year, breaking it down by witness.
Oh, no, I don't have any. I'm not suggesting there wasn't specificity in the presentment of the government's position. I guess what I'm asking is, should we read that it's a total acceptance of the entire government position? I mean, how do we get some comfort level that there was a discernment by the district judge pointing to the specifics of what was presented during the trial or in the grand jury?
The numbers that were found by the district court, the $5.4 million with regard to Ciccini, was directly from the government's version. It was directly based on the government's summary of all these witnesses and all this testimony. And this court has previously held that a court, in making a finding, can make a summary finding of that sort as long as there is sufficient, reliable information set forth for him to make that finding. So, yes, the judge did retain an attorney to find him $5.4 million, accrediting all the witnesses that he had heard at trial, because that was a summary of the trial testimony, and accrediting the testimony of those witnesses who merely testified in the grand jury.
Thank you.
Thank you. The United States respectfully requests that the defendant's convictions and sentences be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Flannel?
Yes. The government makes too much of the proceeds, whether or not there's a container. If someone calls and places a wager on the phone and then the wager's collected a week later, that's money laundering, according to the government. If, in your example, two people rob the bank instead of one and they split those proceeds, that's money laundering, even though it's the commission of the offense and not a subsequent financial transaction. To the sentencing, we didn't argue it because we didn't have time. I don't want the court to think that it's not a big issue for us. We're trying to vacate
the
proceeds.
Your client would be delighted with convictions and a sentence reduced to zero?
Well, we know we're not going home, Judge, but I think with the split of proceeds counts, it's a big issue. The court double counted, in as much as the court considered the same money that was paid to rent machines. In addition, there were 18 witnesses or so that calculated, and we broke it down in our brief, an amount of money that was never testified before the court. As we can see in the proceeds counts, as it becomes money laundering, it becomes a 16-year sentence versus a lower sentence. What we cited in our brief was a case that was charged on the same day, the same scheme, it went before a different judge, and by the fortuitous nature of the judge's calendar, the individual got a year and a day on the same charges because the guidelines were amended. What we have in this case counsel said that the money laundering statute has been used appropriately by the government in this case because it's a subsequent financial transaction, but that's the reason for the new guidelines, because it was used inappropriately. The money laundering statute was used in cases like this where it's a gambling case. As for the waiver, they filed a plethora of arguments, both written and oral. And then the judge comes out and said, I've made a finding, it's 3.2 or 5 point something million. Is there anything further? And of course, anything further means, is there anything further? There can be no other reading of that. That's not a waiver, that's not a relinquishment, that's not a forfeiture at all, because they had already made those arguments. He'd made a ruling. I think I read an opinion by Judge Castillo saying that this isn't the NFL, there's no instant replay. He just made a ruling, he told them what the finding was based upon their written and oral objections.
Yeah, we're the replay, but it's not instant.
Right, right. So we're asking for an instant replay in that case because the objections were made, there was double counting, there was 18 witnesses, many of which agreed they perjured themselves in the grand jury. The court made a blanket finding as to credibility and as to an amount. There wasn't a specific finding. As to the split of proceeds counts, I believe it's an egregious error in as much as the amounts are so great. And if there's no more questions, I think the gun went off on the instant replay. So. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lando. Thanks to all counsel.